Ali Farouk Manesh, a name that will live in infamy for the NCAA tournament, for all Northern Iowa Panther fans, and in Kansas Jayhawk world as well. Ali is initially from Pullman, Washington, where he grew up playing basketball all the time. Him and his family moved to Iowa City, where he ended up going to Iowa City West, and initially was not tall enough, not athletic enough, not good enough to play a lot of minutes for that high school team. So Ali got to work. He improved what he needed to improve and ended up playing a lot of minutes for the really good Iowa City West team at the end of his high school career. After high school, he had no scholarship offers, chose Indian Hills where it didn't necessarily work out for him, so transferred to Kirkwood where he really made a name for himself, again, by putting in the work that he needed to. Ali talks about some great stories at Kirkwood, playing for Coach Wagemeister, and a couple of stories that really changed his mindset in practice and therefore in games as well. After Kirkwood, moved on to Northern Iowa, obviously, and played for Coach Jacobson. Again, tells some great stories about a couple games, about a couple aspects of playing for Coach Jacobson that really changed him as a player and changed those Panther teams that had a couple runs to the NCAA tournament there. After that, went overseas, played 3 or 4 years, ended up coming back and deciding to coach at Nebraska. And then moved on to Drake, where he was an assistant coach and now actually in Colorado State, the great state of Colorado, coaching under as an assistant coach, Nico Medved. Ali tells great stories, as I mentioned. He is a super intelligent coach who will be a head coach eventually whenever he decides to. But it was great connecting with him, as it is always great connecting with these coaches, and connecting the dots with some of the aspects of my background playing at UNI and just after me when Ali made the trip there. We hope you enjoy this episode. As I mentioned, Ali Farouk Manesh. I got the shooter's touch. Can't nobody shoot like me. Fourth quarter down 3, need a 2-and-1. Better call on me, better call on me. If you know you need a shooter, I'm ice cold like a cooler. Get you right though, I can tutor. This that mic flow, I'm a hooper. I got blue faces on blue faces. I'm too. Welcome back, everybody. As mentioned, we have another great guest on the podcast today. Assistant coach of Colorado State men's basketball, Ali Farouk Manesh. Ali, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
I'm excited. It's been a little bit in the works here, getting you on, maybe more so on our end than yours, because as soon as we asked, you said, yep, let's do it. So I was excited. Excited to talk hoops here, see what we have coming. But I know you said you've listened, so let's start. Let's kick it all the way back. And actually, I needed a little bit of refresher and childhood. Obviously played high school hoops at Iowa City West, but how did the journey get you to Iowa, and what was that like? And then what was it like hooping over in Iowa City?
Yeah, so my parents were coaches as well, so they I grew up in Pullman, Washington, out of Washington State, and was going to high school there, and had a good start to my career. It was like kind of that, I had that sophomore year, and then it's, you know, that sophomore year where you start to kind of figure out basketball on the varsity level. And so I was really excited to go back my junior year, because I thought like, hey, I'll be ready to really take a step and help us make a state tournament and whatnot. And then my parents take the job at the University of Iowa. And so I have to move my junior year of high school, and I don't know what it's going to look like. You know, I'm feeling pretty good about where I'm at, and got to make this adjustment, switching high schools and moving to Iowa City. It was basically between City High and Iowa City West on where I was going to go. And they're both way bigger schools than I was where I was at. So I was excited about that in terms of competition level and everything. But, you know, you never know going in a new situation what it's going to be like. And I remember my mom went and met with Coach Bergman at Iowa City West and was talking to him, because we had heard so many good things about the program and his development of players and how many guys he sent on to Division I and how prepared they are when they get there. And so my mom was excited about it and met with him and was like, hey, yeah, we got a really good basketball player. He loves hoops. He's going to be in the gym all the time. And he's like, kind of, okay, that sounds good. And he's like, how tall is he? And she goes, oh, he's 6 foot and he's a white guy. That gets everybody really excited in the basketball world. And so he kind of brushes it off, and he's like, well, I got seven of those guys on the roster and whatever. So I'm kind of coming in with an underwhelming reputation. And it works out, though. Like, I meet with one of my teammates the first day I get there, and it's all hoops. And it was the best thing for me because you had the field house back in the day in Iowa City, and there was games all the time up there. And so I would literally go from playing with our guys in the morning with our team. I'd go back up in the afternoon and play pickup with random college students and, you know, the random crew in Iowa City. So I was getting basketball in all the time, and that was the best 2 weeks of my life, living in a hotel with my mom, not having a house yet. Cause I had nothing else to do besides play video games and go to the gym. Cause there's no friends out there. So I got a lot better during that time, but it was also just a culture shift in terms of learning the game a different way from Coach Bergman. And then also just playing, like, we played all the time up at the field house. And I love that. I got a lot better just from doing that.
Those field house runs, man, were legit. I know my time in Iowa City, I got in quite a few of those, or even when we would come to town for whatever, it's like, we got there on Friday. It's like, let's go to the field house and get some runs in. You just show up, you got three, you got four, you got five, you grab one, and then you can run for as long as you want up there, man.
Oh yeah. It was all, cause there's six courts up there. And like, you had the mix of the high school kids, the college kids, then the old heads who thought they were still good. And it was just a solid mix of guys. And I remember there's always two really good courts. There's the one really good court where you had all the athletes who were like, they're like just talented. Then you had the one court with all the older guys who just knew how to pass the ball, move, cut, space. And we always tried to get on one of those two courts. And when you got on one of those courts, it was like Christmas Day. Now, if you won two, then it was like, this is amazing. Cause now we're on the best court. We get to play a few games here. But if you lost, then you were sitting out, or you'd have to go down to the sixth court and play against a bunch of like bad players now again. So that was, you learned how to compete at an early age, and it was always against older guys. And I swear that's the best thing for kids to do, is just play. Like, so many kids want to work out all the time. And don't get me wrong, I love, like, workouts are great. That's how you improve your individual skills. But at some point, if you can't do it in a game, what are you doing?
Yeah, and I agree, man. You get on those good courts and you win a couple, you start feeling pretty good. It's sometimes about drafting too. You get there and you got to pick two or three guys, because usually you have your team. You're like, oh, these guys look all right. Hey, we need two more. One quick thing on that. I know we were up there playing one time, and we had a buddy with us it was his brother-in-law, and he tried. It was an eighth grader, and I think he stood in the lane, tried to take a charge on Tony Moriaki. Tight end coming down the lane, and I was like, buddy, I'm like, this is a field house, man. One, that's Tony Moriaki, get the hell out of the way. Two, we don't take charges in this, buddy, you know.
That's so funny, because that's how it was, though. Like, you used to have the good football players that would come up in there and play. The Iowa guys would come up there and play with us. Like, it was always really good runs, and I swear that's half the reason why I got better too, was just because I had to go compete against grown men constantly.
So I was playing there like when Gatens was in high school on that City High team, and those dudes were up there all the time too, just running and playing. And I mean, for those Iowa City schools, that's a huge advantage for you guys to be able to go in there. I mean, Regina, same way. I mean, those kids can go in there and you always got a good game, you know. And Algona, I mean, we were pulling teeth to try to get 10 together, and Iowa City, you go and get a game whenever you want.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So let's talk. So junior year, then you come in. You'll have to remind me a little bit. What was, as you mentioned, Iowa City West, a storied program, always had a ton of success. What was it like? What was the 2 years in Iowa City? What kind of success did your high school team end up having?
Yeah, so we ended up having a really good, really good junior and senior season. So my junior year, we were not picked to be great, and we ended up winning our side of the division in our conference. And we end up upsetting Linmar to break like a 25 game win streak for them. That was when they had Jordan Bohannon and those guys, and Grant Gibbs, I think, was a sophomore then. So they had a really good team back then. And so we ended up going to state, lost in the semifinals to Linmar again, and then finished third that year in the state. And so we had a really good team. It was awesome. Great experience. Especially coming from, like, we were 3-3, I think, to start the year, and then we ended up being 20-6 to end the season. So it was kind of one of those stories where we kind of just figured out how to play together and really hit our groove later on in the season. And then senior year, Had a really good year. We were like 22-1 or something. Had one loss to Linmar with Bohannon was a senior that year. And then we lost in the sub-state finals. I still remember that game to this day. Like, I can tell you exactly what happened, all the plays. And I remember it hurt me more than any, it still hurts me to this day. Like, I remember the ref, while I fouled out of the game in overtime, and we're playing at Cedar Rapids, Washington, who we beat the week before by 30. So should have won the game easily. And I'm coming off the bench, and the coach Bergman says to the ref, "You just sent home the best team in the state to the ref," because they made some awful calls down the stretch. And the ref goes, "Yeah, we missed a few calls right there." And I'm like, "I wish I wouldn't."
Not what you want to hear.
I would have rather not heard that at all and just been like, "Hey, we lost." But you know, it's funny how those, it's almost like those high school memories you remember so much more, because those were the guys that you grew up with and you spent so many hours with on and off the court. And I don't know how you guys feel from that, but I remember my high school games sometimes more than anything else.
Yeah, I agree. And that's been a common theme that we've had. I mean, those are guys that obviously you grew up with and spent a significant amount of time with, and just an impactful time of your life as well. And so you were kind of right on the cusp as far as this boom that we've seen here in club and AAU basketball. So what was the summers like? Did you play for a club or AAU team, or what did you do in the summer?
Yeah, so we had it's the Iowa Barnstormers now, essentially. But it was like it was the Iowa Magic. So I had Bryant Kuchera was on that team. Taylor Blum was on that team. So we had a good little roster. Mitch Westfall. So we had some guys that were talented, but we weren't that upper group. That was Martin Brothers back then. Was like, that was the team. That was Jordan Bohannon. Eagle Cedar was all those guys were on that team. And I actually had to play one-on-one tournament. And I can ask Casey Schmidt, who works with the Barnstormers still. He made us do like a one-on-one tournament at tryouts, essentially. And so I had to make my AAU team just to be able to play in the summer. And so I beat everybody in it. I beat the whole roster. And to this day, I give Casey a bunch of crap for that. They're like, I had to beat everybody on our team just to make the team. What did everybody else have to do? But I got to experience that, but I didn't get to play in front of a whole lot of people. Not a ton of games where there was definitely some games where there were coaches there, but I obviously did not do enough to catch anybody's eyes because I didn't get a scholarship offer. So
it's funny you mentioned that too, because when I was in high school and Brian too, I mean, Martin Brothers was the team. I mean, to be completely honest, I think they may have been the only AAU team in Iowa at that point. And you know, myself, Brooks, I mean, Jared Joson, none of us made that team. We didn't have another team to fall back on. And so my dad, Marty McCown, and a couple of dads got together and we just started practicing and said, "Hey, we can make this an AAU team." And you know, we ended up doing it. You know, you talk about coaches watching. I remember the only coaches that came to watch us were obviously you and I, and then the coaches that were watching the teams we were playing against. That's about it. That's how we got noticed. So, you know, AAU, obviously it's humongous now, and you know, a lot has changed, you know, but definitely those deals where it's fun to build those relationships and fun to play against that competition as well.
No, absolutely. It is so much different now. There's probably 8 AAU teams just in the state of Iowa.
At least, know? I would say. Yeah. I mean, if you don't make one team, you can just go try out the next week at another one and see if you make that one.
No, exactly. And that's part of the, I mean, that's some of the issue with AAU right now is it's watered down because there's just too many teams.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk about that all the time, actually. So we agree with you there. Well, let's make a transition here after high school. You go play here for 1 year at Indian Hills and then move on from there. But like, you know, on your end, let's talk a little bit about that. Let us know how that went.
Yeah. So, didn't get a scholarship offer out of high school to Division I, Division II, NAI, anything like that. And obviously that was devastating because it wasn't that I didn't work hard. It was just, I obviously wasn't doing something right. So it didn't happen. And I think I had to come to a realization that like, hey, I have to do more too, you know? And I think that was when things started turning for me, is I stopped thinking about like, why aren't you recruiting me? Why am I not getting this? Why is this not happening to me? As opposed to then I changed my mindset as, okay, well, what do I need to do better? And where do I need to improve? Because I can keep complaining about it, or I can try to make a change in what I'm doing. Cause obviously it's not working. And so I tried to change my habits a little bit. And then it wasn't that I wasn't working hard, but I literally just started shooting all the time. I started working on my left hand more. I started really trying to focus on my body more, like getting in the weight room and really taking it seriously. And it didn't work out at Indian Hills. I had some good games, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out. When, to be honest, our whole freshman class transferred. So in junior college, that's insane because you only have two classes. And we were 31-2. So we were winning too. Usually don't have people transfer when you're winning, but you can read between the lines on that. End up transferring, going to play with your brother up at Kirkwood with Corey, and had a great experience out there. And I remember when we got there, I just felt like I had to win everything. And this was my last go around. Like this was my last chance, if you want to say. And so literally just did everything. I would shoot every single night, Monday through Thursday after practices. I would come back to the gym at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night and shoot and make 300 shots. Sunday night, come back, do the same thing and do that all week long, all through the preseason. And eventually end up breaking the gun, and they had to buy a new gun because it just shot on it so much. And I remember every single drill I was trying to win, every single sprint I was trying to win. Cause I knew this was my last opportunity to make a dream happen essentially. And so just try to take a completely different approach to things. And I got lucky enough that I was around some other guys that wanted to work like that too, like Corey, like Matt, a lot of different guys that were really willing to put in the time. And, you know, if you surround yourself with people that have similar aspirations that you do, like it makes your job easier. It makes it easier to make those sacrifices. And I was lucky enough that I had some guys around me, and I also had some coaches and Coach Wegemeister that wanted to push me too. And I remember one game, we're at Coffeyville, and I think I passed up a three or something, and he yanked me and sat me on the bench, and I'm like, well, that's never happened. And so he sat me down, and he's cussing this whole time, but he's yelling at me, and he's like, why do you go and shoot all these shots if you're not going to shoot them in the game? And no one had really said that to me besides my mom. And my mom was going to say that because that's my mom. But it was the first time a coach had said something like that to me. Like, why are you working this hard and not trying to apply it in the games? And so after that moment, I just remember being like, well, yeah, what am I doing? Like, I work all this time. My dream's right here. Why am I not trying to push for it in the games too? And so from then on, like, I just started shooting and I started attacking. I started being aggressive in everything that I did, and it just took off. And I remember then after that, I remember having like three games in a row with over 30 points, and it was just kind of nothing changed besides I just started becoming more aggressive, and my why kind of picked up, and my understanding of what I needed to do to make these dreams happen wasn't just the work. I needed to start applying it and started believing in myself more and being more aggressive when I was out there.
It's funny how a mindset, I guess shift you might say, can honestly change everything and, you know, make the biggest difference there. So, well, you know, talk about Indian Hills, talk about Kirkwood. I want to talk about Indian Hills versus Kirkwood, in the Knapp Center, which is to this day, probably one of the greatest basketball games I've been a fan in person with. I don't know if you remember much about that game, but, if you do, let's maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I remember that whole game. That's probably the second game I remember the most. That's funny because that was the first time like that my recruitment actually started picking up a little bit. And it was still my favorite game ever because it meant more because the coach on the other sideline didn't believe in me and I knew he didn't believe in me. And so like I felt like I had more to prove. It was just another chip on my shoulder. Like I already had a chip because I wasn't where I wanted to be yet. And so I had to prove all these other people wrong too, but that was the guy that I had to prove wrong the most. And so I'm literally going head to head against him. Like I'm not even thinking about the other players on the other team. And so I'm nervous and I shoot my first two shots are air balls. You probably don't remember that, but first two shots are air balls. I'm like, oh great. This is going to go well. And so I'm clearly like not in the same mindset that I have been before. And I remember just having to calm down because I was so excited. And I was like, I have to prove this guy wrong. Like I have to. And so we play the game out. They got two guys that actually played some time in the NBA on their roster that were freshmen. And we end up winning in triple overtime. And I had 36 points or something. And I remember making the last three to put us up by five, I think, with like 35 seconds left. And coming down, and after I made that shot, I just stared at the coach on the other, on Indian Hills sideline the whole way down the court. Not in like a, probably in a mean way, but I'm literally just staring at him the whole way down, because that was the moment that I was like, that's why I work. That's why I shot in the gym those extra hours. That's why I did all this extra stuff, because so I could be that moment to make that shot and stare you down in the eyes and let you know, like, I decided what my future was, not you, you know? And I think that's, I think everybody has a story like that. I just got lucky enough that I got put in a position to make something like that happen directly against something that meant that much to me. And I think that's where you either decide what, which way things are going to go for you career-wise, personally, whatnot. Like, how are you going to respond to that adversity? Like, I shot two air balls to start. My career wasn't going the way I wanted to. Like, I had this big chip on my shoulder to be like, I have to make this happen. And if Coach Weggs didn't push me, and if I didn't get cut, or if I didn't get treated the way I did at Indian Hills, and people didn't believe in me the way they did before, I don't think I would have had as big a chip on my shoulder to make plays like that and to really be as resilient as I was in those situations. And I look at all the stories of guys, like they all have a huge chip on their shoulder, you know, everybody, even LeBron, like he grew up with a golden spoon for most of that. But like at some point, like he did have to build a chip on his shoulder too, because people eventually don't believe in you either at some point, whether you are the best player in the world or not. Like, there's people that are going to doubt you. And I think that's, it's all dependent on how you respond to that doubt, you know?
Yeah, man. And that's, I mean, like I said, one of the best games I've ever been a part of. And I just found out actually preparing for this that my brother may have a copy of that game. So first I know about it, so I'm super excited for him to come over next time, and we're gonna pop that in the DVD player and watch that again.
He needs to send that to me.
Yeah, well, after I get done with it, obviously. Well, hey, and then obviously, you know, you end up at UNI from Kirkwood, but I mean, after JUCO, I mean, essentially really going through the recruitment process again. So talk a little bit about that. You know, where did UNI come in? Was UNI the only school, or did you have options there?
Yeah, I had then I had options after that, because then that was, so that game against Indian Hills, and then the next three games I had 30 points in the rest of those two, and against good competition. So I that's when the recruitment really started to pick up. But part of the reason for you and I, honestly, was partially because you were there, Adam, and obviously me being with Corey and like always being around Corey, I felt already a kind of connection to you and I in that sense, you know. And then talking to Brooks and knowing that whole situation, I knew they had had success with guys like me. And I think that first time around when I was getting recruited by Indian Hills, there wasn't a lot of guys like me that were having success at Indian Hills. You know, more guys like me were having success at Kirkwood. And I think that's hard to – that's the humility side of it, that you have to understand who you are, and that's where you can become successful. And, like, I don't think I did that initially when I made my first choice. And then my next choice, I made that. And then that's why, at the end of the day, I chose UNI over St. Louis and George Mason and Wichita State, because I felt like they had what I wanted. And they also had – you played with them a little bit. But they had Jordan Eglesieder. They had Adam Cook, who I thought down the road were going to be really good players. There's not a lot of 6'8", 6'9", guys walking around like Adam out there in the Missouri Valley. And there's not a lot of seven-footers, especially today, that look like Jordan Eglesieder. So that was all those factors kind of led into me deciding to go to UNI at the end of the day. And obviously we watched a lot of games because you were playing. And then I think all those things added up to me being like, hey, this is where I want to go.
I think prior to your explosion at Kirkwood, I think Coach Paith was making a few appearances trying to get you to come to Waverly.
I almost did. Like, my family, I got a letter from my uncle while going through this process about why I should be at Wartburg, and JUCO's not a decision for the rest of your life. And literally, like, we almost had a family feud about it, that I wasn't going to Wartburg. Like, it really was. Like, only two schools recruiting, three schools recruiting me were Kirkwood, Indian Hills, and Wartburg. That was it. So it wasn't that far-fetched. Like, I actually talked to Coach Drake the other day, who's an assistant there back then, and he was laughing. He's like, we really thought we were really close to getting you. And I was like, you were. My family almost like made me leave the family because I wasn't going to Wartburg.
No, I remember that, because that would have been right towards the tail end of my career. But I remember him talking, your name coming up and saying how you know, I think we got a chance, this Iowa City West kid, and they were excited. And so it's funny then just to hear full circle on how everything comes about. But that honestly, that's happened more than once. You know, Kirkwood, as you said, has a storied program, relatively close, obviously, to Waverly. But, you know, I know the Warburg staff for years has gone down there and tried to pluck off a few of those guys. And then they really grow and explode in that second year and usually end up getting away from them, which is a good thing. And obviously a good thing it worked out well for you, ending up in Cedar Falls.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Cedar Falls was great. And it would have been great to be in Waverly too, because I have a ton of family there, but it all worked out at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly how it's supposed to. So Adam's probably got a few games that he wants to go over with you and I, but I got to cut right to the chase. And you were talking about Kirkwood and the shot that you hit there. Obviously maybe a little bit of a precursor to the real shot that you eventually hit in your career. And obviously that's the game against Kansas. You know, the kind of just an unbelievable game, unbelievable experience. And so skipping ahead to that, I know we're skipping over a lot of really great games, but what do you remember about not only that game, but that trip in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, I mean, that was it was a blast. It was the second time. So our junior year, we made it. It was kind of like that underdog run. And so we were just excited to be in the tournament that year. And I really believe that, like, you almost have to get that experience before you can make a huge run. And it's happened before people make runs, but we had to have that because our goal was to make the tournament. So I think when we did that, it wasn't that we were satisfied. It was just kind of like, man, we're excited to just be here at this point. And then the next year, we kind of changed our mindset and back to the whole mindset shift. And so we weren't going to be satisfied with just making the tournament. And that's how we approached it. And yeah, we ended up getting Kansas in the second round. And initially when we're sitting in the room looking at the board and Kansas pops up and we're in that 9 seed having to play them if we win, you're a little disappointed. But at the same time, Coach Jake, I still remember him talking about like the opportunity. And that's how we approached it. And I think if he wouldn't have said it like that, I think we would have been more distraught about having to be there and would have been more upset about it. And then we just changed again to thinking like, hey, like, this is a great opportunity. Like, and shoot, at the end of the day, like, we're more known for not making a Sweet 16, but for beating Kansas in the second round. And so if that matchup never happens and we're not a 9 seed and they don't screw us on the seeding, we don't play Kansas. We probably play somebody else that I'm not talking to you guys right now, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned that your junior year, your first year at UNI, you know, it was a little bit of an underdog story, you guys making it. The thing I remember most about that year, obviously the NCAA tournament was awesome, but I believe it was the first game of Missouri Valley conference play. You guys played Indiana State at home and lost to them. You know, it might have been, I can't remember the exact score, but lost. I guess lost that game. And I remember as obviously a fan of you and I, but I was like, man, I really thought we'd have a run this year. I really thought we were going to have a run. And after that game, you know, as a fan, you know, you can't do much about it, but you know, hopes are let down. It's like, man, this was going to be a good year, I thought. And then after that, I mean, just, was there something that clicked? Was it, you know, kind of like you said, was it just you guys starting to learn to play together? I mean, obviously you got you coming in as a starter, you know, a new team. What, just in your mind, what do you think clicked after that game?
Yeah, I think there was a huge adjustment to playing together because Kajou essentially didn't play the year before either because he had the shoulder injury. And then Johnny Moran was a freshman, so he hadn't played. I hadn't played with anybody. So basically, like, it was like having a brand new team, you know. We had Adam and Jordan who had played a little bit. Kajou obviously had been in a college structure and whatnot, but – it was completely brand new team. So everything was new. The culture was new. How we communicated was new. And it took us a while to adjust to that. And I think when it finally switched was we had a practice where, and we've all been through that, where it was just a ball buster. Like if you didn't win the drill, you ran. If you won the drill, you still ran. There was something like every time you ran, but it kind of built a toughness. And I think eventually like that toughness from Kajou and myself and Johnny kind of solidified the group And to be honest, Johnny and I really didn't start playing well until that stretch. And that's kind of what took us off, because Adam and Jordan were playing well. Like, it wasn't their fault. it was basically Johnny and I kind of started making shots finally. Like, I didn't make a shot for a while. And then once that happened, now everybody started buying into roles. Travis Brown, who was a starter, lost his starting spot to Johnny and I. And then he bought into that six-man role and was huge for us down the stretch. And then Lucas kind of emerged as well off the bench. And so we had all these guys that kind of just fit into roles. And the other thing was, we became a humble group. Like, nobody thought they were bigger than the team anymore. And we realized, like, we needed each other. And through that, all of us blossomed. And I think that was a huge thing, is just coming together, but also we all bought into our little niches. Like, I was going to be the guy that would take the threes and opportunistically. Johnny was going to be the hustle, outwork you guy. Kajou was trying to make plays for everybody and guard the other guys one-on-one. Adam was going to have to be an elite defender and score the ball for us, get fouled, get to the rim. And Jordan was Jordan, because Jordan was just – he was a unicorn. Like, there wasn't a lot of Jordans in our league. And so once we started doing that, and then those guys off the bench started adding more to us, it kind of just clicked, and it clicked at Southern Illinois. And that's when it kind of took off, 11 in a row from there. And we had to do it on the road. We beat – so we 0-1 against Indiana State in overtime. Then we beat Southern Illinois at Southern Illinois. Then go to Creighton, beat Creighton at Creighton. And now we're 2-1, winning two games and probably the two hardest road games in the conference at that time of the year, you know. And so that's when – you also have to do it at some point. You know what I mean? Like, if we would have gone to Evansville and won, no offense, but like, if we gone to Evansville in one of those road games, like, it's like, okay, great. But you go to Southern and win at Southern, you go to Creighton and win at Creighton, well, now you start to believe in that work too. Because at some point, like, I can tell you whatever you want, but there has to be some proof to the pudding too, you know? And that was kind of proof that, okay, we're doing the right things, we're coming together, like, we can do this. And like, we all started buying in a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And I that's the key to any coaching, is how bought in can you get your guys? And that's when we fully got bought in, I think, is right. It happened at the Indiana State game. The result didn't show it, but then it continued on from there.
Yeah, and, you know, I will, you know, obviously the NCAA tournament the next year is very, very memorable. One of the most memorable you and I moments that I have. But, you know, I'll never forget that run the year before, you know, after that in Indiana State game. It was awesome. It was, you know, super fun to watch. And like you said, it just seemed like something clicked there. And everybody benefited from that. So, well, let's, I guess, you know, we talked a little bit about it, but let's maybe jump to KU here. You know, I actually rewatched that game, not cause I'm crazy, but I recorded a podcast, about the game. And so I had to rewatch it, and, you know, just reliving some of those moments, you know, some of the big plays there, you know, Eggleseeder starting off and, you know, just crushing Cole Aldrich in that first half. You know, some of the plays Luco, he made in the second half, you know, I also had to remind him he airballed a free throw in that game, which I totally forgot about. And then obviously your shot. If you can, I mean, go over a little bit about the game plan, if you remember much about that. You know, it obviously playing for Coach Jake, you know, I can kind of see what his plan probably was. But for our listeners, you know, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it was we had to always know where Sharon was. I mean, he was probably the best player in the country that year. So Kajou obviously was on him and trying to make him, and it was a good matchup, to be honest, because they're both small, strong built guards. So we felt pretty good defensively about that matchup with him and Kajou going at it. Didn't feel as good about the Johnny Moran and Xavier Henry matchup, 6'7" versus 6'1". But Johnny's tough, and that was Johnny all year. Like, Johnny was the guy that, like, he always had the bad matchup but our coaches knew he could handle it. He wasn't gonna complain. He never said one thing about that guy's 6'7", I'm 6'1". He was just like, this is what I have to do to win. And you always have to have – the one thing we always had Johnny, who was just tough and did whatever it took to win. And then you had Lucas, who was tough and did all the dirty work. And the best teams have guys like that. You have to have some level of talent and really good players. And, like, we had some skilled guys. But – the separators for us was we had Johnny and Lucas, and they probably don't get enough credit, especially Johnny. I know Lucas got sixth man of the year and whatnot and gets a lot of credit, but Johnny probably doesn't get as much credit as he deserves, because he really was kind of that heart and soul of the group and the passionate one that you saw. I mean, you saw we were up 10-2 in that game, and he loses his mind after we make 1-3 in 5 minutes of the game. But that's how he was, and that's and we needed that, because I was a little more calm and cool and collected. Adam was obviously very mellow. Jordan was Jordan, you know? So we had to have one guy that was like kind of the passion guy. And then Lucas was the other one that came off the bench and brought that too. But that team was fun. But that game, especially, we knew they played fast in transition. We knew we had to get back. To be honest, like, the styles of play matched up. And everyone talks about that in the tournament. It's all about matchups. And yeah, they're the number one team in the country, so it's not the best matchup. But in terms of their styles of play, it wasn't going to be that hard for us, you know? The UNLV game was probably harder because it was so much different. It was such a contrast of style in terms of them playing up and down and pressing. Like, that was complete. Nobody in our conference does that. Whereas everyone kind of plays more similar to Kansas in the Missouri Valley. So in terms of that, not that the Kansas game was easier or anything, but the matchup wasn't that bad, besides that they had really, really good players.
How much of a quick turnaround do you think that had, not only for you guys as far as mindset and being like, you know, if we get there, like, you don't have a ton of time to think about, oh, KU and, oh, geez, kind of psych yourself out. But on the same time, too, they didn't have a ton of time to prepare for the Panthers either. So you think that played a role in how things shook out?
I think it definitely helped us, because, I mean, we were feeling good. We won that UNLV game at the buzzer, essentially. So we're kind of riding on a high. And they didn't play well against Lehigh, I think, is who they played first. And so it wasn't like they kind of limped into the next round. They kind of just by default won that game. And so we were feeling good about the way we were playing. And approaching that game, I remember watching the film and being like, I have no idea how we're going to win this game. Because the other thing is, too, like, they're on ESPN all the time. So I'm watching them play all year long. At Kirkwood the year before that, 2 years before that, I'm watching Sharon Collins win a national championship. And I'm like, man, that guy's awesome. Like, I'm a fan of him. And then now I'm checking into the game right next to him, you know? And so it was kind of like that awe factor. You have to embrace it to a certain extent, because it is cool. Like, to be from where I was watching him and being excited, I'm like, wow, like, I won a national championship. What a stage to be on. I wish I could do that. To 2 years later, I'm literally checking into the game next to him, you know? And so it's yes, embrace it. Cause, like, to ignore the fact that that's like a cool moment, you don't really fully affect how everything's going on. And then I'm just thinking about that the whole time. So I think all of us had to embrace the fact that we're playing Kansas. Like, wow, this is cool. Like, it is awesome, but it doesn't change what I'm here to do and who I am. You know what I mean? And I think that's hard to do sometimes, and people want to ignore that, but you can't ignore that. You got to embrace it. And that's how you attack it. Then it's just like, if you're fearful of something, you don't just stay and be like, man, I'm really scared. Like, this is like, okay, I'm going to ignore it. Well, no, you're scared of it. It's okay. Like, embrace that fear. And that way you can overcome it. But if you don't do that, like, we would have been scared the whole game then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath and everything that kind of came, the whirlwind after the shot and the result of the game. But maybe we have talked about it. I know we communicated a little bit after everything was going on. But actually, a buddy of mine and I were down in Kansas City, in Overland Park at one of the biggest sports bars over there, watching that game with just a sea of blue. I mean, this place was just packed, KU fans, and me and my buddy roll in, and we're just sitting there watching the game with my brother-in-law, who's also a KU grad. And it's, like you said, he got out early start. It was 10-2 or whatever, and everyone's like, oh, Cole didn't come to play. I thought it was funny they referred to him by his first name, because none of them knew him, you know, and they're like, Cole didn't come to play. We're going to get beat. Like, it's over. And I was like, it's 4 minutes into the game. Like, relax. Like, you guys are the number one team in the country. And you guys just continue to hang around and hang around and hang around. And then, obviously, the result we all know, and the shot towards the end, you know, me and my buddy were probably the only ones geeking out of, you know, about 200 people in this place. And we had lady threaten to throw rocks at us. And, I mean, it was just – it got wild. But then by the end, they were all, like, just – congratulating us like we were part of the team or something, and what a great win it was. And some of them, like, were offering us their tickets to the Final Four. I think it was at St. Louis that year or something, or the next round I think was in St. Louis. And they're like, hey, we don't need these tickets anymore. Do you guys? And we're like, we're not associated with the school. We're just fans of the boys and all that. And so it was obviously a really neat experience. And I can't move off of this without knowing exactly what the thought process was going in when you caught that ball and you're like, what do I do? And the reason, was it going back to breaking that gun at Kirkwood, or why did you decide to pull the trigger?
Yeah, no, that's funny. Cause there's so many moments from that game that I remember specifically. And, the one that's my favorite when I've watched the game before is when, one of the announcers is like, well, if you're UNI, like, what do you do now? When it was like a 10-point, 8-point game or something, like, what do you do now? And they're like, well, you just got to play your game, play steady and whatnot. And we throw a lob against their zone. and that's how you have to play though. Like, that was the thing. Like, we stayed aggressive the whole time. Like, we weren't going to all of a sudden just be like, cause it was an 8-point game. Like, we're going to freak out, just keep doing what we're doing. But part of what you do is you're aggressive, you know? And so we throw the lob right when they're announcing, like, you know, just play steady, take care of the ball, blah, blah, blah. No, we're throwing a lob. But in terms of the last shot, I remember, which is crazy, and I still use this example with my players sometimes, that about staying in the moment and not worrying. You can't let your feelings or how what's been going on outside of this affect who you are and what you've done in your preparation. Because I made my first 4 shots. And then I missed, I don't think a lot of people know this, I missed my next 7 shots and didn't make a shot in the second half until that 3 with 30 seconds left. So all that, like what you said, the gun, me trying to walk on an aisle and them telling me no, no scholarship offers out of high school, an assistant coach in high school telling me, like, why are you going to JUCO? You have good grades. Like, you aren't going to get better and get a scholarship. Like, all those things added up to, like, yeah, I'm shooting that. And then Coach Wagemeister telling me to shoot it. All those things added up to, like, I'm shooting that 100% of the time, no matter what. Even if the shot clock's probably closer together, I'm probably still shooting it. Just because that's what you're taught to do. And once you build enough habits that your automatic thoughts take over how you play the game, there's no decisions anymore. I just react. And so I'm open, I'm shooting it. And Adam probably feels the same way. Nope, and you shoot it. If you've done it enough times, like, it's not that shot, no matter what's going on, how much time's left, the situation, everything else that's happening around you, to me, it's just another shot. The minute you start thinking about it like that, or if you ignore the fact that it's a big moment, that's when you miss. You know what I mean? Like, I knew what the moment was. Like, I knew what was happening, but I knew I was prepared too. And I knew that I had done all this work to be in that spot. So I felt like I deserved it too. Like, that's your fault for leaving me open, not me. You know?
And that's completely on brand too for Shooter's Touch. That's why we got you on here, man.
And then I think it was after that make, it was just sprint. And then just like I was saying about the automatic thoughts, like, once you build enough habits, your automatic thoughts take over. After I made it, I didn't think about celebrating. I was like, oh shit. Oh, sorry. Get back on defense now. And so I sprint back on defense, and my roommate Jake Cook takes the charge, and that's when it's like, we won the game. Now everything that just happened culminates to that charge from Jake Cook taking it.
So, and then to continue, kind of go full circle here with my story. So we're sitting there, obviously, after the game, we closed out quite a few beers during the game, went out afterwards, Kansas City, lived it up, turned on the TV the next morning, and Ali's on the DP show. Like, how wild was not only obviously the aftermath and some of the 15 minutes of fame that came with that, but also then you guys got a trip out to the ESPYs and got to kind of rub shoulders with some of the bigwigs out there. And so what was it like following everything once you kind of came back down to reality, or maybe while you're still in the clouds?
Yeah, it was crazy the next day at school. Well, so we played on Saturday. So Sunday morning, I didn't get a lot of sleep. And I remember my phone lasted, like, I turned it on, lasted like 5 minutes, and it just died. And by the time we got back to charge it after we got home, I had like over 450 text messages. I only had like 300 contacts. So we land, and it was awesome. There's people lined up everywhere, and like, we're excited. And I remember I still went right back down to our basement with me, Jake, and Adam, and watched a movie. And then the next morning, I get up, and like, I didn't sleep at all. And we have to go on CBS with Coach Jake, and I look like a zombie, and I have no idea what's going on even. And so doing an interview, I don't even know what I said half the time. Like, I would love to see that interview, because I'm sure it's awful. And then the next day I got 8 a.m. class in my finance class, and I'm barely alive for that too. And so I do the classic. I put my hand over my forehead and I'm sleeping. And so class ends or whatever. I get a text from Derek Nettens. And he texts me and goes, hey, you're going to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And I'm like, what? And then my professor comes over and I'm like, oh, hey, how's it going? And I'm sleeping the whole time. And he goes, hey, if you need any help with any of your homework or what's going on in the class, like, just let me know. I know you guys are in a busy time right now. And I'm like, I appreciate it. I need a lot of help. Even if I don't make that shot, I still need help. And so we walk out of class and the whole time, like everywhere I'm walking, like I'm like high fives, like two guys get down on their knees and start bowing to me. It was some of the weirdest stuff ever, but fun too. Like it's exciting because I always joke with PJ Hogan about this because 6 weeks before that, we're playing Southern Illinois on ESPN2 and I have a class, like a 3 o'clock class or something. And these guys, I'm sitting in the same row I always sit in. And, you know, as a college player, you're always wearing your gear. So I'm always wearing UNI basketball stuff. And so they're talking about the game and they're like, hey, yeah, it's on ESPN2. Like they're ranked in the top 25, like talking to each other, like, are you guys going to go to the game? And they're all like, yeah, I think so. We got to go early to get tickets. And they turn around to me and go, are you going to the game? Do you know where you can get tickets? And I'm like, yeah, I think I'll be there. And so six weeks later, now there's guys in the hallways like high-fiving me and stuff. And I'm like, dude, those guys just think I was like a big UNI basketball fan. Like I just had all the gear. Like they must have thought I was just some dude that just loved UNI basketball. But it was a whirlwind though, that's for sure. And Carl McDonough, who was our SID at the time, he really helped me with that too, navigating that whole process. I'd love to talk to Colin about that because I'm sure he probably dealt with almost as much stuff as the rest of us during that time, just navigating interviews for me, for Coach Jake, for Adam, Jordan. Like it was a whirlwind for a lot of us.
Definitely something you won't ever forget anytime soon, that's for sure. So, and it's obviously fun for all of us as fans of not only you, but of you and I, but of Iowa basketball in general, to be able to, you know, live through that experience and remember those memories as well. So definitely good times. And so then you had the opportunity, you went over and played professionally for, how many years did you play professional?
4 years.
Okay, so four years, got to continue the career overseas and continue to hoop a little bit. And then eventually you decided, all right, let's get back stateside and get into coaching. Or how did the transition from playing professionally into your – you started as a GA at Nebraska, right? How did that transition happen into coaching?
Playing professionally was awesome. It was a great experience. Got to see the world. Got to play longer, make some money at the same time. It was an awesome experience. And then we actually got pregnant. And so that was part of the reason why I'd stopped playing. And so once Mal and I, we got pregnant with Ty, our oldest. And so we decided to stop playing because he was born September 30th. And so she didn't want to have the baby in Europe. And obviously if I was going to go over there, I was going to have to be there. So it was just, it was a lot going on. I was going to go back to the same club team actually too. So it would have been a great situation, but I felt like I was in a good place. Coach Miles at Nebraska was talking to him and I got lucky enough that he gave me an opportunity to be a GA. And I thought I couldn't pass that up. Like that was, I learned a great system from Coach Jake, from Coach Wagemeister, from Coach Bergman. And now I got to experience overseas and learn from those coaches. And now I get to go and learn from Tim Miles, who's built programs at North Dakota State, at Southwest Minnesota State, at Colorado State. And now he's doing the same thing in Nebraska. I was like, how do I pass this up? I know I want to coach eventually. I can't pass this opportunity up. And so like everything else in life, there's some sacrifices that have to be made for another dream. And so this sacrifice was I had to stop playing. And so went that route and really enjoyed it. Learned a lot from Coach Miles. Dude runs a program and it's ABCD. He's got everything planned out. That was the greatest part about that is just learning what all goes into a program. Because as a player, you don't think about those things. You just think, hey, those coaches think about X's and O's and then they come to practice. You know what I mean? And like we're in meetings for 2 hours thinking about what we need to do for practice. How do we need to change this? Why is that guy not playing so well right now? There's so many more things that you don't think about as a player sometimes that as a coach, like it's so many more hours. Like you might see the 2-hour practice, but all the preparation for that 2 hour practice, we're talking about like 10 hours of work, probably, like me watching the film individually, then me meeting with the coaches. So we're talking about 5 hours before that, then come back together again and think about, okay, well, how do we do the drill better? And you don't think about that as a player. You just think, oh, like we're doing the shell drill, you know? And so that was a great experience in terms of just getting used to that and kind of the transition of playing to coaching, and that there's such a fine line between the two of being one of the guys as a player and then being a coach, but also being able to kind of play that mentor role. And sometimes when I was first starting, I was being more of the, like the player guy. Like I was all with the players and hanging out with them. And like, those were my guys. And I needed to transition a little bit more to that mentor role. Like, you're still my guy, but like, I have to, I'm more of that mentorship. Like I have to help you get better. I'm trying to help you grow, as opposed to like, I'm trying to play video games with you. You know what I mean? And I think that's the hardest thing, transitioning from being a player to a coach, is understanding that and holding guys accountable in that aspect of it. Cause you don't do that as a player. And as a coach, it's a completely different situation.
Yeah. I've got an opportunity to hear Coach Miles speak at one of the coaching clinics here. And yeah, I mean, just listening to that guy talk for about a half hour, I fell in love with what that guy was doing as a coach and in his program and stuff too. So definitely had to be a good opportunity. And it sounds like you took a lot from him and in that program. Before we transition to Drake, when you said that you always knew that you kind of wanted to coach, but was there a time that you could pinpoint back when you were like, you know what, obviously you come from coaches, your parents both coaches. And so did you know, like, hey, here's the deal. I'm going to play basketball for as long as I can, and then I'm going to get into coaching? Or what was that thought process like for you?
Yeah, I wasn't really one of those guys that was like, hey, I'm going to coach someday. You know, I really never thought about that. Like I love playing basketball. And so I think that was it. Like, I just loved basketball so much. And I knew that if I couldn't play anymore, what's the next best thing? Coaching, right? And so that was where it all stemmed from, is I just loved basketball. And so it was kind of just the natural progression. It wasn't necessarily that, like, hey, I want to be a coach. Like, it was, no, I just loved basketball. I loved development. I loved how a team came together. I loved building that culture and environment and all those things that I learned from those coaches in terms of, like, Coach Weggs had such a strong culture and environment. And then Coach Jake had a culture that was different than Coach Weggs' culture. And then Coach Miles had a different culture. And now with Nico, now he has a different culture. And it's been a fun progression learning how you can coach. And in basketball, we're all playing the same exact game, but we're all playing it so differently. And everyone's having success differently too. And that's what's fun about it. It's just, you have to decide what fits you as a coach. And that's what's been fun for me, is figuring out how I want to coach, what I want to do, and also just trusting like who I am and building my, how I want to coach off that. You know what I mean? Yep. And I think that's sometimes where guys get mixed up in coaching. It's like, they want to be whatever. You want to be Coach K, or you want to be Bobby Knight. Well, if you don't have a personality like Bobby Knight, well, you're not going to coach like Bob Knight then. Cause then no one believes that, you know, you can be the toughest dude in the world, but then if you aren't consistently like that, it falls apart eventually. And so you have to be exactly who you are. Otherwise, like, players, and you guys know this playing, that like, you can always sniff out the fakes. Like, it's easy, and you can do that fast. And that's the same thing in coaching. Like, I can figure out really quick whether you really believe in me, whether how good you really want to make me, and how much you want to help me off the court too. And I think if you're not truly genuine to who you are, you can't coach. It doesn't matter how much X's and O's you are, no, or anything else like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Players can snip that out right away. And so obviously the more genuine, the better. So one of my things that I enjoy most about doing this, to get an opportunity to talk with you coaches, is the coaching community is so small. It feels like it's big at times, especially for outsiders, but it's so small. And so it's fun for me to see behind the curtain a little bit and the connections and stuff that's going on. And so with that, then you go from GA to player development at Nebraska, and then eventually come over and join Nico and his staff here in Des Moines at Drake. And so how did that come about? How did the transition from Nebraska to Drake come about?
Yeah, it's just like you said, it's just a small world of coaching, because Coach Miles was at Colorado State, and Coach Medved was an assistant for him while he was at Colorado State. Then another assistant at Nebraska, Jim Molinari, was the head coach at Minnesota, and Nico was an assistant for him for a year there. Then Ben Johnson, who's now the coach, he's coached at Xavier, who was at Minnesota and coached me at UNI, played for another assistant on our staff, Dave Thorson, at De La Salle High School. And so they've always been tight. And now Thor was tight with Nico, so he wanted to come back into college coaching, so they linked up. And so we had all these connections to people that we all knew really, really well. Like I knew those people really well. Nico and Coach Thor knew those people really well, but we didn't know each other at all. And so it's just what you said, it's such a small circle. And I got lucky enough that, one, it was a job in Iowa. Two, the first guy he tried to hire didn't accept it. And then three, all these people vouched for me. And all those things added up. And at the end of the day, it really is part of its luck. Like I got lucky that it was Nico. I got lucky that it was in Iowa at Drake. And then I got lucky that the first guy turned it down. And you always need a break. Like that's the biggest thing. It's just like in basketball, some of it's luck. Part of the reason why we were good at UNI, we had no injuries. No one was ever hurt. We had the same roster the whole year.
Yeah, you definitely, you just got to appreciate and be thankful for the opportunities that come about. But more than anything, I mean, from anything that you've mentioned, it's also taking advantage of those opportunities when they're presented to you. And it definitely sounds like you've done that. And another opportunity that came about was obviously for Nico to go back to Colorado State. And obviously you wanted to stay on staff and went with him. But what was that decision like for you? Obviously, I think that at least from our conversations, we're excited and enjoyed Des Moines. And obviously, like you mentioned, being in Iowa. But again, opportunity presents itself. And it sounds like it was something that you couldn't pass up.
Yeah, no, it was – I mean, Nico is kind of the same as Coach Miles. Like, Nico took a chance on me too, you know, taking a Missouri Valley job and gave me an assistant coaching position. Never been recruiting, had obviously played, but – I'd never been in that role before. So he took a gamble on me. So it wasn't like I was going to be like, I'm going to stay here. See ya. I trusted him and what he was about too. That was probably the biggest thing. Like he's about family. He's about developing these guys, not only as basketball players, but off the court as well. And we do a program with this guy named Rod Olson who helps develop leadership and develop these guys into better people. But he invests in that. He doesn't just talk about it because everyone says, well, we want to develop people too. Well, we have this program where this guy specifically comes in once a month and meets with our guys for an hour and a half and then meets with us once a month as well to develop us into better leaders, better people, better husbands, better men. And we actually pay him money to come do that. And so that shows me that like he's truly invested in developing people. And that's why I wanted to come with him too, because everything that I believe in, he believes in. And that's hard to find. And you guys – you can be any business, right? If you align yourself with people that have the same morals and moral compass that you do and believe in the same things that you do, it makes it easier to work for them. And there's better synergy within the staff. And that was one of the reasons that I love working for Nico, and it would be really hard for me to ever leave.
No, that's great. And yeah, 100% agree. It doesn't matter what business or team or where you're at. It's all about that environment and putting yourself in those opportunities and giving yourself a chance to have those opportunities. And so, you know, as you're still pretty early on here in your path and your coaching path, but as you've gone through and obviously played for a number of coaches and, you know, coached with and had a number of guys on staff, what are a few pieces and maybe different roles that you've kind of learned each step of the way from the different staffs that you've been on?
Yeah, I got lucky at Nebraska. There was so many good coaches on staff. Like from Coach Molinari, I learned the urgency of practice, like the pace of practice. If you make things chaotic at times, there's obviously a teaching element to things, but he would make things chaotic to the point where guys had to just play hard and scramble around and figure it out, because that's half of basketball is just playing harder than the other team. And you have to create situations where there are some chaos, because there's going to be moments of chaos within basketball, whether you're in scramble situations or missed shots or different opportunities or a misread or a new play you haven't even gone over. It's those things you have to be ready for. And the only way you can is by creating chaos in practice sometimes. Then Coach Hunter, who's at Indiana now, taught me about how to organize recruiting. Coach Beckner taught me about development and how to be professional and hold guys to certain standards and accountability. Then I come to Drake and I learned from Nico about like really building relationships with guys and really and kind of slowing down at times. Cause I was a guy as a player, I was like work, 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 work. you know, and at times, like, you need to slow down, you need to relax. Like, you got to keep guys in perspective too. There has to be a balance to this as well. From Coach Thorson, obviously, I learned about connecting. Like, that guy's the most connected human I've ever met in my life. Like, give him 2 minutes and he'll figure out like some way that you guys have some deep connection. And it happens with every single person. So I've been lucky to be around a lot of good people. And I've also been smart enough to know that I don't know everything and I need to take away as much from these people as possible and steal from them. And I think that's what's awesome about this business too, is that you can connect. It's a small community, but at the end of the day, it's a copycat business and I'm just copying somebody else that does it better than me.
Yeah. And that's, you know, as Brian mentioned, one of the best parts about our podcast is the fact that him and I get to connect with coaches like you, you know, other players that we've watched play, that we've read about, heard about and stuff like that. And I mean, with all the coaches we've talked to, I guess the common likeness that they have for coaching is, you know, connecting with people and connecting with players and the connections you have with other coaches. And as you mentioned, you know, there is a certain element of luck to it, you know, taking advantage of situations. So, you know, it's awesome to hear your story and that it's a common, you know, a common practice in the industry, I guess you might say. But, well, Ali, we like to wrap up our podcast with a little segment called Rapid Fire. Brian will ask you just some easy questions, maybe some questions that are a little bit tougher, and just answer them with the first thing that comes to mind.
All right, let's do it.
All right, man. All right. First one. We'll go twofold on this. Just cause you played and coached. So best visiting arena as a visitor, best visiting arena you played and coached in.
Ooh, well, Duke was good until we started getting blown out. Kansas for coaching. For playing though, Hilton.
Yeah, that's a good one. I know you didn't always draw the toughest assignment, but who is the toughest guard you've ever had to take on?
I got the good matchups. Probably Osiris Eldridge. He was phenomenal at Illinois State.
Yeah, we actually just talked about him on our last episode too, with Chris Jans. Used to be an assistant with Osiris, and Osiris was there when I played at UNI too. He was real good.
Yeah, he was different.
Yep.
Going a little Cedar Falls here. You choosing Peppers or Mulligans?
Mulligans.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm right there with you. Adam, I think
that's
goes tough, way.
Though. That's a split. You're splitting hairs now.
What's your favorite basketball shoe?
The Kobe's.
Got a number? Specific number?
The eights.
Okay.
That was the last ones I had overseas, the snake print ones.
Yep.
Those are the first low shoes I liked. I never liked low shoes until I had the Kobe's.
Man, me neither.
I was the same way, man. I didn't have any lows until I got the Kobe, I think Kobe sixes. And those are still like one of my favorite. I mean, Kobe sixes, I wore the low KDs, like threes, fours here when I'm playing around here. And I didn't think I'd go to Lowe's, but man, those, they're something different. So
especially the Kobe's back in the day.
Yeah. So sticking on that Kobe theme, who's the GOAT? Who's the best basketball player ever?
Jordan.
What'd you think of that Last Dance documentary series?
Oh, it was awesome. Like I think it showed obviously his competitive side and whatnot, but also showed like what we were talking about, like the chip on your shoulder. Like at some point, most of these guys that are like really, really good or great at what they do had some big failure that just killed them at some point. Like I was showing one of our guys the Tom Brady clips about him like being picked 199th in the sixth round, and the dude still can list off every single guy that was picked ahead of him.
Yeah,
like that's the chip, you know.
Well, even that one game where Jordan just made his own chip when that guy told him nice game or whatever afterwards.
I don't know if you guys did that ever, but I would make stuff up sometimes just to not like the other guys on the team.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean,
like the way they looked at you or something.
Yeah, I would always just take it. I would take it way too personally. Like even if they smiled at me, like, why are you smiling?
Yeah, it could be, and it didn't even matter. I mean, it could be the way that they looked or, like, the shoes or the way that they shot the ball. You're like, man, I don't even like that kid. Never even did anything, but take whatever motivation we can get. Yeah. must have road trip snack. What do you got to grab on it before you go head out on a road trip?
Man, I'm not like a snacker. I really don't snack like that. The only thing I would say, and my wife would probably say this when we're driving back to like Council Bluffs, to see her family, would be the Sour Patch Kids. That's the go-to nice. In the car, at least.
That's a good one. Sometimes I obviously four kids around here, I'm stealing their fruit snacks all the time too. You got to get on some of those.
Exactly.
All right. So when Adam and I come out to Fort Collins to catch a game, where do we got to go to eat before we come by the stadium?
Well, you got to do the full beer tour then. Like you got to go. We got to go to Odell's Brewery. We got to go to New Belgium Brewery, and then we'll see how you guys are doing after that. And then we can go up to the Horsetooth Mountains and hang out the mountains and see the sunset.
Oh man, love it.
If like this is the one thing about this place, like if you like beer, like there's microbreweries all over. We're actually like, I think per capita, we're the microbrewery capital of the world.
Wow. I believe that.
So it's a cool atmosphere. You can get so you rent bikes and go on the full tour of all the breweries in town. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that sounds legit.
Training wheels on those bikes or you got balanced all the time.
Yeah. I've only done like the Odell's to New Belgium, so I haven't made a full circle, but I'm assuming by the time you make a couple trips, like you're gonna need some training wheels or something.
We'll maybe just stick to those two if we make it out there.
Yeah.
you need those motorized bikes that just go on their own after a little while too. So, well, good, man. Last one here, a little bit of a loaded question for you. Hopefully a good one. I know you touched on it, but what's the best thing about coaching out there at Colorado State?
I mean, the location's awesome. Like it's 300 days of sunshine. So every day you wake up, like the sun's out and you're just in a better mood when the sun's out. And it's out all the time, which I love that about Colorado. And then probably the other part is like, we have really good kids right now. Like we do, like we have academic teams and I haven't gotten one text message this whole semester about any of them messing up. And so I'm blessed that I work with some really good kids that I don't have to, like, once practice is over, like, I'm not worried about what they're doing off the court, you know, especially in a time like this, like where there's a lot more precautions going on. It makes life a lot easier for me and it's good for my kids. I got three kids now, so they got some great role models to look up to too.
It all comes back to that culture, like you mentioned, that you guys are building and creating out there, and definitely has its advantages. And so, Coach, we appreciate you coming on, taking some time. Obviously, we'll continue to follow on your journey, but we'll be excited to see how the team and everything shakes out for you guys this year. Fingers crossed. Hopefully, everything stays on course. You guys haven't heard any updates or anything. We're still going to have basketball this winter, correct?
As far as I know, we're practicing like we are. So
if COVID and the forest fires don't get you, we're going to get some hoops in, right?
Exactly. If we don't, then we'll just have a beer tour out here.
Awesome. Well, yeah, Coach, just like Brian said, we appreciate your time. It was great to reconnect with you. Great to talk to you here. And as he mentioned as well, you know, we hope to watch at least a couple games of yours over the winter here. But and to our listeners, as usual, wherever you catch your podcast, if you enjoyed what you hear, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating. And you can catch us anywhere on social media. Search The Shooter's Touch on Facebook and Instagram and the Twitter at Shooter's Touch IA. And as usual, remember, shooters shoot. Echoes are ringing my mind, hustling harder than ever before. Saying I change cause I like when I shine. The diamonds hit different like Mike in his prime. I got the shooter's touch, yeah. Can't nobody ball like me. No. Blue face, hunters on hunters on hunters. That's really all I see.